Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Forest Kingdom Saga, the Hawk and Fisher series. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Danny Gavigan, Ren Casey, Andy Clements, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Mort Shelby, Tim Getman, Scott McCormick, Yasmin Toison, Michael John Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, Nanette Savard, Casey Platt, and Colleen Delaney. Hawk and Fisher, Book One. Haven was a dark city. The narrow streets huddled together, the plain stone and timber buildings leaned on each other for support. Outleaning upper stories bowed to each other like tired old men shutting out the light. Yet even in the shadows, one found little relief from the midsummer heat. The glaring sun scorched down on the sprawling city, driving all moisture from the air. The streets ran parched, dusty, and thick with buzzing flies. A seaport, Haven usually got all the rain it wanted, and then some, but not in midsummer. The long days wore on, and the baking heat made them a misery of sweat and thirst and endless fatigue. The days sweltered, too hot to work, and the nights too hot to sleep. Tempers grew short and frayed, but not enough to brawl in the heat. Birds hung on the sky like drifting shadows, but there was never a trace of a cloud or a breeze. Haven at midsummer became a breeding ground for trouble. The heat stirred men's minds and brought forth hidden evils. Everyone watched the skies and prayed for rain, and still the simmering summer dragged on. Hawk and Fisher, captains of the city guard, strolled unhurriedly down Chandler Lane, deep in the rotten heart of the north side. It was too hot to hurry. The grimy, overshadowed lane was a little cooler than most, which meant the heat was only mildly unbearable. Flies hovered over piles of garbage and swarmed around the open sewers. The squat and ugly buildings stood black with soot from the nearby tannery, and the muggy air smelled strongly of smoke and tannin. Hawk strode tall, dark, and no longer handsome. He wore a black silk patch over his right eye, and a series of old scars ran down the right side of his face, showing pale against the tan skin. He wore a simple cotton shirt and trousers, but didn't bother with the black guardsman's cloak required by regulations. It was too hot for a cloak, and anyway, he didn't need one to tell people he was a guard. Everyone in Haven knew of Captain Hawk. He didn't look like much. He was lean and wiry rather than muscular, and he was beginning to build a stomach. He wore his dark hair at shoulder length, swept back from his forehead and tied with a silver clasp. He had only just turned 30, but already there were a few streaks of gray in his hair. At first glance, he looked like just another Bravo. Not as young as he once was, perhaps a little past his prime. Still, few people stopped at the first glance. There was something about Hawk, something in his scarred face and single cold eye that gave even the drunkest hard case pause. On his hip, Hawk carried a short-handled axe instead of a sword. He was very good with an axe. Captain Fisher walked at Hawk's side, echoing his pace and stance with the naturalness of long companionship. Isabel Fisher stood easily 6 feet in height, and her long blonde hair fell to her waist in a single thick plait. She was in her mid to late 20s, and handsome rather than beautiful. Her face showed a raw-boned harshness that contrasted strongly with her deep blue eyes and generous mouth. Like Hawk, she wore a cotton shirt and trousers and no cloak. The shirt hung half unbuttoned to show a generous amount of bosom, and her shirt sleeves were rolled up, revealing arms corded with muscle and lined with old scars. She wore a sword on her hip. Her hand rested comfortably on the pommel. Hawk and Fisher, partners, husband and wife, guardians of the city law, Known, respected, and mostly feared throughout Haven, even on the lower north side, where the very rats went round in pairs for safety. Hawk and Fisher were the best, and everyone knew it. They were honest and hardworking, a rare combination in Haven, but more important still, they were dangerous. Hawk looked about him and scowled slightly. Chandler Lane was deserted, not a soul in sight, and that was unusual. The afternoon was fast turning into evening, but even so, there should have been people out selling and buying and making deals. On the lower north side, everything was for sale if you knew where to look. But all around, the doors and shutters were firmly closed, despite the stifling heat. The shadows lay still and undisturbed. It was like looking at a street under siege. Hawk smiled sourly. If his information was correct, that might just be the case.
There's going to be a full moon tonight.
That'll bring out the crazies. Though how anyone has the energy even to plan a crime in this heat is beyond me.
You do realize this is probably nothing more than a wild goose chase, don't you?
Not again, Isabel, please. The word is he's hiding right here at the end of the street. We have to check it out.
3 months. 3 months we've been working on that child prostitution racket. And just when we're starting to get somewhere, what happens? The word comes down from above and we get pulled off the case to go looking for a vampire.
Yeah, and all because we raided the Nag's Head. Still, I'd do it again if I had to.
Fisher nodded grimly. The Nag's Head was a hole-in-the-wall tavern on Salt Lane, just on the boundary of the East Side slums. The upper floor housed a brothel, and word leaked they were interested in acquiring children. Cash in hand, no questions asked. Child prostitution had been illegal in Haven for almost 7 years, but there were still those with a vested interest in keeping the market open. Like many other places, the Nag's Head kept itself in business by greasing the right palms. But one man made the mistake of trying to buy off Hawk and Fisher. So they paid the place a visit. Hawk and Fisher had kicked in the door and burst into the Nag's Head with cold steel in their hands. The staff and patrons took one look at them, and a sudden silence fell over the crowded room. Smoke curled on the stuffy air, and the watching eyes shone bright with fear and suppressed anger. Hawk and Fisher headed for the stairs at the back of the dimly lit room, and a pathway opened up before them as people got hurriedly out of their way. Three bravos crowded together at the foot of the stairs with drawn swords. They were big, muscular men with cold, calculating eyes who knew how to use their swords. Hawk cut down two of them with his axe while Fisher stabbed the third cleanly through the heart. They stepped quickly over the bodies and pounded up the stairs. The upper floor was ominously quiet. Hawk and Fisher charged along the narrow landing, kicking open doors as they went, but most of the occupants were long gone, having disappeared down the fire escape at the first sound of trouble. One of the prostitutes couldn't get away. Hawk found her in the last room but one. She was dressed in torn silks too large for her and wore gaudy colors on her face. She was chained to the wall by the throat, and her back ran red from the wounds of a recent whipping. She sat slumped against the wall, her face pressed against the rough wood. She was almost 12 years old. Fisher joined Hawk in the doorway.
Oh, damn.
The chain was too heavy to break, so Hawk levered the bolt out of the wall with his axe.
Sweetheart, we're here to help. It'll be all right now.
Fisher tried to comfort the child, but she was too frightened to say much. She'd been abducted on the street 2 years ago and brought to this room. Her abductors put the chain around her neck, locked it, and kept her in the room ever since.
You're free now, child.
No, I'm not. There's a man who comes to visit me. He was here today. He'll never let me go. You can't protect me from him. No one can. He's important.
Who is he?
No man ever tells me his name.
Hawk and Fisher never did find out who he was, but he must have had influence. Only 2 days later, the child was stabbed to death in the street. Her attacker was never found. Hawk and Fisher were officially taken off the case and sent to join the other guards searching for the supposed vampire terrorizing the north side. They raised hell with their superiors and even talked about quitting the guard, but none of it did any good. The word came down from somewhere high above, and there was no arguing. Hawk and Fisher shrugged, cursed, and gave up. There would be other times. Besides, it seemed there really was a vampire. Men, women, and children fell victim to a nighttime attacker. Occasionally, bodies turned up drained of blood. There were dozens of sightings and as many suspects, but none of them led anywhere. Then a lamplighter came to see Hawk. The two captains of the guard could not deny the horror in the man's voice as he told of the dark figure he saw crawling up the outside of the house in Chandler Lane.
All the guards in Haven, and that man had to choose us to tell his story to. Oh, why us?
Because we're the best. So obviously we're not afraid to tackle anything, even a vampire.
Ugh, we should have settled for second best.
Not in my nature, or yours.
Their low, cheerful chuckles seemed out of place in the silence. For the first time, Hawk realized just how quiet the empty street was. It was like walking through the empty shell of some village abandoned by its people, but not yet overgrown by the forest. Despite the heat, Hawk felt a sudden chill run down his back, and the sweat on his brow felt suddenly cold.
This is no time for nerves to get the better of me.
Hawk and Fisher finally came to a halt before a decrepit two-story building almost at the end of the lane. Paint peeled from the closed front door. Crumbled pieces of the pitted stonework lined the base of the building. Rotted wooden shutters hid the two narrow windows. Hawk looked the place over and frowned thoughtfully. There was something disquieting about the house, something he couldn't quite put a name to. It was like a sound so quiet you almost missed it, or a scent so faint you could barely smell it. Hawk let his hand fall to the axe at his side.
Vampire. Revenant. That which returns.
Hawk had never seen one of the undead, and didn't know anyone who had. He wasn't altogether sure he believed in such things, but then he didn't disbelieve in them either. In his time, he'd known demons and devils, werewolves and undines, and faced them all with cold steel in his hands. The world harbored dark places, older by far than anything built by man, and there was no denying that people disappeared from the north side of late. One person in particular.
Well?
Well what?
Well, are we going to just stand here all afternoon? Or are we going to do something? In case you hadn't noticed, the sun's getting low in the sky. It'll be dark inside an hour. And if there really is a vampire in there...
Right. The undead rise from their coffins when the sun is down.
Ugh.
Hawk smiled slightly as he took in the goose flesh on Fisher's bare arms. Neither of them cared much for the dark, or the creatures moving in it. Hawk stepped up to the front door.
Open in the name of the guard!
Silence lay across the empty street like a smothering blanket, weighed down by the heat. Hawk wiped at the sweat running down his face with the back of his hand.
I should have brought a water canteen and waited for backup.
You know we have to get to the vampire while he still sleeps. And Counselor Trask's daughter is still missing.
The counselor's missing daughter elevated the vampire case to high priority. As long as the vampire kept to the poorer sections of the city, preying only on those who wouldn't be missed, no one paid much attention to him. But once he snatched a counselor's daughter out of her own bedroom, in full view of her screaming mother...
She should still be alive. Vampires are supposed to take 2 to 3 days to drain a victim completely. She can't become one of the undead until she dies and rises again. At least that's what the legends say. We should have stopped off and picked up some garlic. That's supposed to be protection, isn't it?
Garlic? At this time of the year? You know how much that stuff costs in the markets? It has to come clear across the country, and the merchants charge accordingly.
All right, it was just a thought. I suppose Hawthorne is out as well?
Definitely.
I assume you've at least brought the steak with you. In fact, you better have the steak, because I'm not about to go in there without one.
Relax, my love. I've got it right here.
Fisher pulled a thick wooden stake from the top of her boot. It was over a foot long and roughly sharpened to a point. It looked brutally efficient.
As I understand it, it's quite simple. I hammer this through the vampire's heart, and then you cut off his head. We burn the two parts of the body separately, scatter the ashes, and that's that.
Oh, sure. Just like that.
Hawk paused a moment, looking at the closed door before him.
Did you ever meet Trask or his daughter?
I saw Trask at the briefing yesterday.
Fisher slipped the stake back into her boot.
He looked pretty broken up. You know them?
I met his daughter a few months back. Just briefly. I was bodyguarding counselor to George at the time. Trask's daughter had just turned 16 and she looked so bright and happy.
Fisher put her hand on his arm.
We'll get her back, Hawk. We'll get her back.
Yeah. Sure. Do it by the book.
Still no response from the house or from any of its neighbors. Hawk glanced up and down the empty street. He was aware that this could be a trap of some kind. After 4 years in the city guard, Hawk knew to follow his gut. Without being able to do that, you didn't last 4 years.
All right. My instincts aren't screaming that this is a trap, so we go in. But watch your back on this one, Isabel. We take it one room at a time by the book and keep our eyes open, right?
Right. We should be safe enough as long as the sun's up. The vampire can't leave his coffin till it's dark.
Yeah, but he might not be alone in there. Apparently most vampires have a human servant to watch over them while they sleep. A kind of Judas goat. A protector who helps lure victims to his master.
You've been reading up on this, haven't you?
Damn right, ever since the first rumors. I wasn't going to be caught unprepared, like I was on that werewolf case last year.
He tried the door handle. It turned jerkily in his hand. The door swung slowly open as he applied a little pressure. Hawk jumped, despite himself. He pushed the door wide open and stared into the dark and empty hall. Nothing moved in the gloom. The shadows stared silently back. Fisher moved softly in beside Hawk, her hand resting on the pommel of her sword.
Strange, the door wasn't locked. Unless we were expected.
Let's get on with it. I'm getting a very bad feeling about this.
They stepped forward into the hall and closed the front door behind them, leaving it just a little ajar. Never know when you might need a quick exit. Hawk and Fisher stood together in the gloom, waiting for their eyes to adjust. Hawk had a stub of candle in his pocket, but he didn't want to use it unless he had to. All it took was a sudden gust of wind at the wrong moment, and the light would be gone, leaving him blind and helpless in the dark. Better to let his sight adjust while he had the chance. Fisher stirred uneasily beside Hawk, and he smiled slightly. He knew how she felt. Patiently standing and waiting just wasn't in their nature. They always felt better when they were doing something, anything. Hawk glared about him into the gloom. There could be someone hiding in the shadows, watching them, and they'd never know it until it was too late. Something could already be moving silently toward them, with reaching hands and bared fangs. Hawk felt his shoulders growing stiff and tense. It didn't matter what was out there. Hawk carried his axe and Fisher stood at his side. Nothing else mattered. His eyesight slowly grew used to the gloom, and the narrow, completely empty hall gradually formed itself out of the shadows. Hawk relaxed a little.
You all right?
Yeah, fine. Let's go.
The hall ended in a bare wooden stairway that led up to the next floor. Two doors led off from the hall, one on each side. Hawk drew his axe and hefted it in one hand. The heavy weight of it was reassuring. He glanced at Fisher and smiled as he saw her draw her sword from its sheath. He caught her eye and gestured for her to take the right-hand door while he took the left. She nodded and padded quietly over to the right. Hawk listened carefully at his door, but everything was quiet. He turned the handle and eased the door open an inch, then kicked it in. He leapt into the room and glared quickly about him, his axe poised and ready. The room lay empty, no furniture, bare walls. A little light filtered past the closed shutters, taking the edge off the gloom. The woodwork was flecked with mold, and everywhere was thick with dust. There was no sign to show the room had ever been lived in. The floorboards creaked loudly under Hawk's weight as he walked slowly forward. There was a strong smell of dust and rotten wood, but underneath that, Hawk caught a faint but definite smell of corruption, as though something long dead lay buried close at hand. He couldn't decide if the smell was really there or if he was imagining it. He moved quickly around the room, tapping the walls, listening to the echo. But there was no trace of any hidden panel or passageway. Hawk stopped and stood in the middle of the room, looking around him to check he hadn't missed anything, and then went back into the hall. Hawk found Fisher waiting for him. He shook his head, and Fisher shrugged disappointedly. Hawk smiled slightly. He already knew Fisher hadn't found anything. If she had, he'd have heard the sound of battle. Fisher wasn't known for her diplomacy. Hawk started toward the stairs, and Fisher moved quickly in beside him. The bare wooden steps creaked and groaned beneath their feet, and Hawk scowled. If there was someone here watching over the vampire, they had to know someone else was in the house. You couldn't put your foot down anywhere without some creaking board giving away your position. He hurried up the rest of the stairs and out onto the landing. He felt a little less vulnerable on the landing. There was more room to move if it came to a fight. The floor, too, lay thick with dust and rat droppings. The bare wooden walls were dull and scarred. Two doors led off from the landing to their right. It was just as gloomy as the ground floor hall. Hawk thought fleetingly of his candle before deciding against it. If the sound hadn't given them away, a light certainly would. Hawk moved over to stand before the first door and listened carefully. He couldn't hear anything. If this house did turn out to be empty, he was going to feel ridiculous. He looked at Fisher and gestured for her to guard his back. She nodded quickly. Hawk tried the door handle, and it turned easily in his grasp. He pushed the door slightly ajar. He darted forward into the room, axe at the ready. Another empty room. Without looking around, Hawk knew the look on Fisher's face.
I said this was a wild goose chase, Hawk.
He didn't look back. He wouldn't give her the satisfaction. He glared about him, taking in the darkened room. A sparse light seeped past the closed shutters to show him a wardrobe to his left and a bed to his right. A large wooden chest stood at the foot of the bare bed. Hawk eyed the chest suspiciously. It looked to be a good 4 feet long and 3 feet wide, quite large enough to hold a body. Hawk frowned. Like it or not, he was going to need some light to check the room out properly. He peered about, and his gaze fell on an old oil lamp standing on the floor by the bed. He bent down, picked the lamp up, and shook it gently. He could feel oil sloshing back and forth in the base of the lamp. The house might appear deserted, but somebody had to have been here recently. He took out flint and steel and lit the lamp. The sudden golden glow made the room seem smaller and less threatening. Hawk moved closer to the chest and crouched down before it. There didn't seem to be any locks or bolts. He glanced at Fisher, who pulled the wooden stake from her boot and nodded for him to try the lid. He clutched the axe tightly and threw the lid open. Hawk and Fisher relaxed a little as they took in the pile of old bed linen that filled the chest. The cloth was flecked with a rather nasty-looking mold and had obviously been left in the chest for ages. Even so, Hawk rummaged gingerly through the pile, just in case there might be something hidden under it. There wasn't. Hawk wiped his hands thoroughly on his trousers. All this taking it slow and easy was getting on Hawk's nerves. He suddenly wanted very badly just to run amok and tear the place apart until he found the missing girl. But he knew he couldn't do that. Firstly, if there was no one here, the house's owners would sue in the courts. And secondly, if there was a vampire here, he was bound to be well hidden, and nothing less than a careful, methodical search would find him. One room at a time, one thing at a time, by the book, follow the procedures, and he and Fisher might just get out of this alive. He moved over to the bed and got down on his hands and knees to look underneath it. A big hairy spider darted out of the shadows toward him. Hawk fell backwards. The spider quickly disappeared back into the shadows. Hawk quickly regained his balance and shot a dirty look at Fisher.
Go ahead, laugh. Ha ha.
Hawk picked up the lamp from the floor and swept it back and forth before him. There was nothing under the bed but dust. Not in the chest and not under the bed. That only left the wardrobe, though it seemed a bit obvious. Hawk clambered to his feet, put the lamp on the chest, and moved over to stand before the wardrobe. It was a big piece of furniture, almost 7 feet tall and 4 feet wide.
Wonder how they got it up the stairs.
Hawk took a firm hold on the door handle, gestured for Fisher to stand ready, and jerked open the door. Inside the wardrobe, a teenage girl hung naked from a butcher's hook. Her eyes were wide and staring. She'd been dead for some time. Two jagged puncture wounds showed clearly on her throat, bright red against the white skin. The steel tip of the butcher's hook protruded from a bloodless wound in her right shoulder, just above the collarbone. The wound suggested she was already dead when the hook went into her. Hawk reached forward to gently touch the dead girl's hand. The flesh was icy cold.
Damn. Oh, damn.
It's her, isn't it? Counselor Trask's daughter.
Yes, it's her.
Oh, the vampire must have been thirsty. Or maybe just greedy. I doubt there's a drop of blood left in her body.
Look at her. 16 years old and left to hang in darkness like a side of beef. She was so pretty, so alive. She didn't deserve to die like this. No one deserves to die like this.
Easy. Take it easy, love. We'll get the bastard that did this. Now let's get the girl down.
What?
We have to get her down, Hawk. She died from a vampire's bite. If we leave her, she'll rise again as one of the undead. We can spare her that, at least.
Yes, of course.
They took the body off the hook and out of the wardrobe, then laid the dead girl out on the bed. Hawk tried to close the staring eyes. They wouldn't stay shut.
Here, let me try these.
Fisher put two coins on the eyes to hold the lids down.
I don't even know her name. I only knew her as Trask's daughter.
A heavy weight slammed into Hawk from behind. He and his attacker fell sprawling on the floor, and the axe flew out of Hawk's hand. He slammed his elbow back into his attacker's ribs and pulled himself free. He scrambled away and went after his axe. The attacker lurched to his feet, and Fisher stepped forward to run him through with her sword. The man sidestepped the lunge and grabbed Fisher's extended arm. His fingers crushed her arm, grinding the muscles against the bone. Her sword fell from her numbed fingers. She clawed at his hand and couldn't move it. He was strong, impossibly strong, and she couldn't tear herself free. He flung her away from him. She slammed against the far wall and slid dazedly to the floor. Hawk started forward, axe in hand, and then stopped dead as he finally saw who his attacker was.
Trask!
Hawk gaped at the nondescript middle-aged man standing, grinning, before him. The counselor was little more than medium height and painfully thin, but his eyes burned in his gaunt face.
She was your daughter, you bastard! Your own daughter!
She will live forever! So will I! My masters promised me this. My daughter was afraid at first. She didn't understand. But she will. We will never grow old and ugly and die and lie forever in the cold earth. We will be strong and powerful, and everyone will fear us. All I have to do is protect the master from fools like you.
Trask darted forward, and Hawk met him with his weapon. He swung his axe double-handed with all his strength, and the wide metal blade punched clean through Trask's ribs. The counselor staggered back against the bed. Hawk pulled his axe free and got ready to hit him again if necessary. Trask looked down at his ribs and saw the blood that flowed from the gaping wound in his side. He dipped his fingers into the blood, lifted them to his mouth, and licked them clean. Hawk lifted his axe, and Trask went for his throat. Hawk fought for breath as Trask's bony fingers closed around his throat and tightened. He tried to swing his axe, but he couldn't use it at such close quarters. Hawk dropped the axe and grabbed Trask's wrists, but the counselor was too strong. Hawk's gaze began to dim. He could hear his blood pounding in his ears. Fisher stepped in beside them and cut at Trask's right arm with her sword. The gleaming blade sliced through the muscle and the arm went limp. Hawk gathered the last of his strength and pushed Trask away from him. Trask lashed out at Fisher with his undamaged arm. She ducked under the blow and ran her sword through his heart with a single thrust.
What?
Trask stood very still, looking down at the gleaming steel blade protruding from his chest. Fisher jerked it out, and Trask collapsed, as though only the sword had been holding him up. He lay on his back on the floor, blood pooling around his body, and glared silently up at Hawk and Fisher. As they watched, the light went out of his eyes. Hawk leaned back against the wall and felt gingerly at his bruised throat. Fisher stirred Trask's body with her boot. When he didn't react, she knelt down beside him and felt cautiously for a pulse. There wasn't one. Fisher nodded, satisfied, and got to her feet again.
He's gone, Hawk. The bastard's dead.
Good.
Hawk frowned at how rough his voice sounded. He wouldn't have minded, but it felt even worse than it sounded.
You all right, Isabel?
I felt worse. Could Trask be the vampire, do you think?
No. He hasn't got the teeth for it. Besides, we saw him at the briefing yesterday morning, remember?
Yeah, right. Trask was just the Judas goat. But I think we'd better stake him anyway, just to be sure.
Let's see to the girl first.
Sure.
Hawk pounded the stake into her heart. It was hard work. He let Fisher stake Trask while he cut off the girl's head as cleanly as he could. There was no blood, but that somehow made it worse. Cutting off Trask's head was no problem at all. When it was finished, Hawk and Fisher left the room and shut the door quietly behind them.
I thought the air would smell fresher on the landing, but it doesn't.
Hawk held up the oil lamp he'd brought from the room and studied the next door in its flickering light.
He has to be in there somewhere.
Hawk nodded slowly. He looked at her and then frowned as he saw she was holding a wooden stake in her left hand.
How many of those did you bring?
Three. I used two on Trask and his daughter. If there's more than one vampire in here, we're in big trouble.
You always did have a gift for understatement.
Hawk opened the door a crack, stepped back a pace, and then kicked it in. Hawk stepped cautiously into the room, his axe in one hand and the lamp in the other. He stood in yet another empty room, save for a heavy metal bed pushed up against the far wall. Fisher moved slowly around the room, tapping the walls, looking for hidden panels. Hawk stood in the middle of the room and glared about him.
He's here somewhere. He has to be here somewhere.
Hawk moved over to the bed and looked underneath it. Nothing but dust and shadows. He straightened up and looked at Fisher. She shook her head and looked uneasily about her. Hawk scowled and looked back at the bed. And then he smiled slowly as an idea came to him.
Isabel, give me a hand with this.
Between them, they got the bed away from the wall, and Hawk studied the wall paneling carefully in the light from his lamp. He smiled grimly as he made out the lines of a hidden panel, fixed his axe blade into one of the cracks, and applied a slow pressure. A whole section of the wall swung open on a concealed hinge. Behind the panel was a hidden compartment, and in that compartment lay a huge coffin. Hawk felt his mouth go dry just looking at it. The coffin was 7 feet long and 3 feet wide, built from a dark red wood Hawk didn't recognize. Glyphs and runes had been carved into the sides and lid. He didn't recognize them either. Hawk looked at Fisher, standing close beside him. Her face shone pale in the dim light.
Come on, let's get it out of there.
The coffin was even heavier than it looked. They had to drag it into the room, inch by inch. It smelled bad, of blood and death and decay, and Hawk had to keep turning his head away in search of fresher air. When they finally got the coffin out of the hidden compartment and into the room, they stepped back to take a look at it.
Big, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, as soon as I get the lid open, you get that stake into him. As soon as the stake's home, I'll cut off the head. I'm not taking any chances with this one.
Got it. We've been on some dirty jobs in the past, Hawk. But I think this has got to be the dirtiest.
Remember the girl. Now let's do it.
They bent over the coffin. The lid flew open, knocking them both backward. The vampire sat up in its coffin and grinned at them with pointed teeth. Hawk's hand tightened around the haft of his axe till his fingers ached. He thought he knew what a vampire would look like. He didn't. The creature before him might once have been a man, but it wasn't anymore. It looked like what it was, something that had died and been buried and then dug its way up out of the grave. Its face was sunken and wrinkled. A bluish tinge colored the dead white skin. The eyes shone a dirty yellow, without pupil or retina, as though the eyeballs rotted in their sockets. A few wisps of long white hair frayed away from the bony skull. The horribly thin hands held fingers little more than claws. But the real horror lay in subtler things. The vampire wore black, rotting robes. Graveyard lichens and moss grew here and there on the dead skin. Its chest didn't move because it no longer needed to breathe. And it smelled like rotting meat left to hang too long. It rose up from its coffin in a single smooth movement and looked at Hawk and Fisher with its empty yellow eyes. Hawk looked away despite himself, and his gaze fell on the shuttered window. No light showed around the shutter's edges.
Oh, we're too late. The sun's gone down.
The vampire stepped elegantly out of its coffin. Its bare feet made no sound on the wooden floor. Fisher wrinkled her nose at the smell.
Dirty, stinking bastard. Lying down or standing up, it makes no difference. Let's do it, Hawk.
Hawk sprang forward, swinging his axe double-handed at the vampire's neck. The creature put up a spindly arm to block the blow. The axe bounced off. Hawk's hands went numb from the impact, and it was all he could do to hang onto the axe. Fisher thrust at the vampire with her stake, using it like a dagger. The vampire avoided the blow easily and knocked Fisher sprawling with a single backhanded blow. She lay where she had fallen, her head swimming madly. There was an inhuman power in the creature's slender frame. Fisher clutched desperately at the wooden stake and struggled weakly to get her feet under her. The vampire looked down at her. Hawk swung his axe at it again. The vampire raised its hand and caught the heavy blade in mid-swing. The creature wrenched the weapon from Hawk's hand and threw the axe away. It reached for Hawk with its bony hands. Hawk darted back out of range and looked desperately about him for another weapon. The undead bent over Fisher. It grabbed her by the shoulder. The claw-like fingers sank into her flesh. Blood ran down her arm in a steady stream. She tried to break free and couldn't. The vampire drew her slowly closer, grinning widely to show her its long, pointed teeth. Fisher tried again to stab the vampire with the stake. It grabbed her wrist and squeezed hard. The feeling went out of her fingers and she dropped the stake. It rolled away and disappeared into the shadows. Hawk watched helplessly. He'd found his axe again, but he didn't dare attack the vampire. Cold steel was no use against it. He needed a wooden stake. He looked wildly about him and his gaze fell on the coffin. A vampire must always return to its coffin before break of day. Hawk grinned savagely as the answer came to him. He stepped forward, lifted his axe, and brought it swinging down onto the side of the coffin. Hawk jerked the blade free and struck again. The side sagged in and splinters flew in the air. The vampire threw Fisher aside and darted forward. Hawk dropped his axe, grabbed the heaviest shard from the coffin, and buried it into the vampire's chest as the creature reached for him. For a moment, they stood facing each other, the yellow eyes and grinning mouth only inches away from Hawk's face. And then the vampire collapsed to the floor. The creature of the night clutched at the thick wooden chunk protruding from its chest. Hawk threw himself down beside the vampire, snatched up his axe, and used the flat of the blade to hammer the splinter into the vampire's heart. The undead tore at him with its clawed hands, but Hawk didn't care. He hit the wood splinter again and again, driving it deep into the vampire's chest. With every blow he struck, Hawk saw the dead girl's face as she hung from the butcher's hook. Then it was Fisher's face, and she wasn't in the wardrobe. She knelt at his side.
It's all right, Hawk. It's over.
What? Oh, God, you're safe. Oh.
He looked down at the vampire. The dirty yellow eyes stared sightlessly at the ceiling, and the clawed hands lay still at its sides. He raised his axe one last time and cut savagely at the creature's neck. The steel blade sliced clean through and sank into the wooden floor beneath. The vampire seemed to collapse and fall in upon itself, and in a few seconds there was nothing left but dust. He pulled his axe out of the floor and then sat back on his haunches. Some of the tension began to drain out of him. He looked wearily at Fisher, still kneeling beside him.
You all right, Isabel?
I'll live.
Well, we got the vampire. Not exactly according to the book, but what the hell? You can't have everything.
Hawk and Fisher rose painfully to their feet and leaned on each other a while until they felt strong enough to make their way back down the stairs. They left Trask and his daughter where they were. Burning the bodies could wait. Let the backup unit earn its pay for a change. They slowly made their way through the empty house and out into Chandler Lane. It was still hot and muggy, and the air stank of smoke and tannin. But after the house and what they'd found in it, the lane looked pretty good to them.
You know, there has to be an easier way to make a living.
At the house of the sorcerer, Gaunt, the party was just beginning. It was an old house situated in one of the better parts of the city. The party comfortably filled the parlor, a large room that took up half the ground floor. The walls were lined with tall, slender panels of beechwood, richly worked with carvings and motifs. The ceiling boasted a single huge mural by one of Haven's most famous painters. But even without all that, Gaunt's parlor would have been impressive enough simply for its collection of priceless antique furniture. Chairs and tables and sideboards of an elegant simplicity mingled with the Baroque styles of decades past. It was a tribute to the sorcerer's taste that the contrasting styles mixed so compatibly. His parties were renowned throughout Haven. All the best people, wonderful food, and plenty of wine. Invitations were much coveted among the city's high-quality people, but only rarely received. Since taking over the old De Ferrier house some 4 years earlier, Sorcerer Gaunt shot up the social ladder with a speed other newcomers could only envy. Not that Gaunt himself was in any way a snob. At his select affairs, the elite of politics and business and society mixed freely, whatever their calling. But this evening, the party was a strictly private affair for a few friends. Counselor William Blackstone was celebrating his first year in office. Blackstone was a large, heavy-set man in his mid-40s, always well-groomed, polite, and disarmingly easygoing. He had a politician's smile and a fanatic's heart. Blackstone was a reformer, and he had no time for compromise. He'd done more to clean up the city of Haven in his 1 year as counselor than the rest of the council put together. This made him very popular in the lower city and earned him the undying enmity of the rich and powerful who made their living out of Haven's dark side. Unfortunately for those with a vested interest in other people's misery, Blackstone was himself quite wealthy and not in the least averse to putting his money where his mouth was. At the end of his first year in office, the odds on his surviving a second year were being quoted as roughly 4,000 to 1. When Blackstone heard this, he laughed and bet 1,000 in gold on himself. His wife stood at his side as he talked animatedly with the sorcerer Gaunt about his next crusade against the child prostitution rackets. Catherine Blackstone was a short, good-looking brunette and only slightly less feared than her husband. In her day, she'd been one of the finest actresses ever to tread the boards in Haven. And though she put all that behind her on marrying Blackstone, she still possessed a mastery of words that left her enemies red-faced and floundering. Catherine had always had a gift for the barbed bon mot and the delicately judged put-down. She was also not averse to a little discreet character assassination when necessary. Gaunt, himself, looked to be in his mid-30s, but was reputed to be much older. Tall, broad-shouldered, but elegantly slim, he dressed always in sorcerer's black. The dark robes contrasted strongly with his pale, aquiline features. His voice was rich and commanding, and his pale gray eyes missed nothing. He shaved his head, but indulged himself in a pencil-thin mustache. Gaunt arrived in Haven from no one knew where, some 4 years ago. He immediately made a name for himself by single-handedly cleaning up the infamous Devil's Hook area. Devil's Hook was a square mile of slums and alleyways backing onto the main docks, a breeding ground of poverty and despair. Men, women, and children worked appalling hours for meager wages. Prices in the Hook were carefully controlled to keep the people permanently in debt. Those who spoke out against the conditions suffered intimidation and murder. The city guard avoided the Hook rather than risk a war with the gangs who ran it. Then the sorcerer Gaunt came to Haven and walked into the Hook unarmed to see for himself the conditions. He walked out again some 2 hours later. Not long after, the guard were called in to start the long business of carting away the dead bodies. Every member of every gang was dead, and none of them died easily. The Hook held a celebration that lasted over a week. Certain businessmen tried to send new people into the Hook to start the various businesses up again, but Gaunt simply visited each man in turn and pointed out that any attempts to run sweatshops would be taken by him as a personal insult. Conditions within the Hook began to improve almost overnight. Gaunt poured himself more wine and savored the bouquet, even as Catherine Blackstone looked askance.
Darling, I don't know how you can drink that stuff. Hillsdown has some excellent orchards, but their grapes aren't worth the treading.
Gaunt smiled politely.
Ah, I have no palate for wines, but there's always been something about the northern vintages that appeals to me. They're not particularly subtle, but there's no mistaking their power. If this wine were any stronger, it would leap out of the bottle and mug you. Would you care to try some, Councillor Blackstone? William?
Perhaps just a little. I had hoped it would get a little cooler once the sun went down, but I'm damned if I can tell the difference. Looks like it's going to be another long, dry summer.
He gulped thirstily at the wine the sorcerer poured him and nodded appreciatively. Catherine tapped him gently on the arm.
You be careful with that stuff. You know you've no head for wine.
Blackstone nodded ruefully.
A grave drawback in a politician's life. Still, it has its bright side. Because I spend most of the evening with a glass of water in my hand, I'm still there listening when other people are getting flustered and careless.
That's right. Sometimes I'm surprised you don't go around taking notes.
Oh, I have an excellent memory.
When it suits you.
No, no quarreling.
Don't be silly, dear. We enjoy it.
So, William, how's your new bill going? Is the debate finally finished?
Hey, it looks that way. With a bit of luck, the bill should be made law by the end of the month, and not before time. Haven depends on its docks for most of its livelihood, and yet some of the owners have let them fall into a terrible state. Once my bill becomes law, those owners will be compelled to do something about renovating them, instead of just torching the older buildings for the insurance.
Of course, the council will help them out with grants for some of the work, just to sweeten the pot.
One of your better ideas, that.
I'll be interested to see how it works out, though I have a feeling it won't be that simple.
Nothing ever is.
How's your latest project going, Gaunt? Or aren't we allowed to ask?
It's no secret. I'm afraid I'm still not having much success. Truth spells are difficult things to put together. All the current versions produce nothing but the literal truth. They don't allow for nuances, half-truths, and evasions. And then, of course, there's subjective truth and objective truth.
Darling, you'd think I'd know enough by now not to inquire into a sorcerer's secrets. Magic must be the only thing in the world more complicated than politics.
Ho, ho, ho. You obviously haven't had to spend half an evening listening to an old soldier talking about military tactics. And speaking of which, aren't the Hightowers here yet? You did say they were coming.
They'll be here.
Good. I want a word with Lord Hightower. He's supposed to be backing me on my next bill, but I haven't seen the man in almost a month. It wouldn't surprise me if he'd started getting cold feet.
No, I shouldn't think so. Roderick's all right when you get to know him. These old military types can be a bit of a bore when it comes to reliving all their old battles, but their word is their bond. If he said he'll support you, he will. Count on it.
Well, it's not his support I need so much as his money. Politicians can't live on applause alone, you know. The kind of campaigns I run are expensive. They need a constant flow of gold to keep them going. And even my resources aren't unlimited. Right now, Hightower's gold would come in very handy.
Mercenary.
At the other end of the huge parlor, Graham Dorimant and the witch called Visage helped themselves to the fruit cordial in the silver punch bowl. As a refreshing fruit drink, the cordial was something of a letdown, there being too much emphasis on the various powerful wines involved and not nearly enough on the fruit. But Dorimant was well known for drinking anything, providing he was thirsty enough. And the current heat wave left him very thirsty. Graham Dorimant was medium height, late 30s, and somewhat overweight. He smiled frequently, and his dark eyes held an impartial warmth. He'd been Blackstone's political advisor for almost 3 years, and he was very good at his job. He boasted an encyclopedic knowledge of Haven's electoral system, and he knew where the bodies were buried. Sometimes, literally. Dorimant maintained first-name relationships with most of the council, and quite a few of their staffs. He knew who could be persuaded, who could be browbeaten, and who could be bought. He knew when to talk and when to push, but most important of all, he had no political interests himself. Ideologies left him cold. He didn't give a damn one way or the other. He aided Blackstone simply because he admired the man. Dorimant himself was lazy, amoral, and uninterested in anything outside Haven, but he nevertheless found much to admire in a man who was none of these things and who attacked life with a zest Dorimant could only envy. Though he rarely admitted it to himself, Dorimant found more fun and excitement in his time with Blackstone than at any other time in his life. He drank thirstily at his fruit cordial and smiled winningly at the witch Visage. Dorimant fancied himself a ladies' man and aspired to an elegance beyond his lazy nature. He wore nothing but the finest and most fashionable clothes, but lacked the self-conscious elan of a true dandy. He simply possessed too much of a sense of humor to be able to take fashion seriously, saving his vanity for his hair. Though in his late 30s, Dorimant's undeniably thinning hair gleamed jet black. The witch Visage smiled back at Dorimant and sipped daintily at her drink. She was in her early 20s, with a great mass of wavy red hair tumbling freely about her shoulders. Her skin was very pale, and her striking green eyes dominated her broad, open face. She possessed a subtle wildness about her, like an animal from the forest, recently tamed. Men sensed the wildness and felt its intoxicating pull, but even the most insensitive knew instinctively that her constant slight smile hid very sharp teeth. Visage stood tall for a woman, almost 5'9", but painfully thin. Dorriman felt he should take her out to a restaurant and see that she ate at least one good meal before he took his wicked pleasure with her. Such a paternal, protective feeling was new to Dorriman. He pushed it firmly to one side.
"Well, my dear, how is our revered master? Your magic still keeping him safe and sound?"
"Of course. As long as I am with him, no magic can harm him. And you, sir, does your advice protect his interests as well as I protect his health?"
"I try, of course. A man as honest as William is bound to make enemies. He's too open and honest for his own good. If he would only agree to turn a blind eye now and again..."
"He would not be the man he is. And neither of us would be interested in serving him. Am I not right?"
"As always, my dear. Would you care for some more cordial?"
"Thank you. I think I will. It is very close in here. Are you not having any more?"
"Perhaps later. I fear all this fruit is terribly fattening. I must watch my waistline."
"That shouldn't be too difficult. There's enough of it."
Dorriman looked at her reproachfully. Hawk and Fisher stood together before Gaunt's front door, waiting for someone to answer the bell. The sorcerer's house was a fair-sized two-story building, standing in its own grounds, situated near the eastern boundary of the city. A high wall surrounded the grounds, the old stonework mostly buried under a thick blanket of ivy. The grounds had been turned into a single massive garden, where strange herbs and unusual flowers grew in ornate patterns, subtly disturbing to the eye. The night air hung thick with the rich scent of 100 mingled perfumes. Light from the full moon shimmered brightly on the single graveled path. The house itself betrayed no particular character. It stood simply and squarely where it had stood for hundreds of years, and though the stonework was discolored by wind and rain and the passing of years, its very simplicity suggested a strength that would maintain the house for many years to come. The front door stood large and solid before them. Hawk eyed the bell pull dubiously, wondering if he should try it again in case it hadn't worked the first time. He tugged impatiently at his high collar and shifted his weight from foot to foot. Both he and Fisher wore the formal guard's uniform of navy blue and gold, topped with their best black cloaks. The heavy clothes were stiff, uncomfortable, and hot. The two protested loudly before they set out, but to no avail. Guards must look their best when mixing with high society. To do otherwise would reflect badly on the guards. Hawk and Fisher had relented, eventually.
"Leave your collar alone. You're not doing it any good."
"I hate formal clothes. Why did we have to draw this damn duty? I thought that after staking a vampire, we'd have been entitled to a little time off at least, but no. Just time for a quick healing spell, and off we go again."
"Nothing succeeds like success. We solved the vampire case where everybody else failed, so naturally we get handed the next most difficult case, bodyguarding Blackstone."
Hawk shook his head dolefully.
"The only really honest counselor in the city. No wonder so many people want him dead."
"We ever meet him?"
"Shook his hand once, at an election rally."
"Did you vote for him?"
"Well, the other guy was handing out money."
"An honest guard. You stayed bought."
"Like hell. I took their money. Voted for Blackstone anyway, and defied them to do anything about it. Didn't exactly make their day."
He grinned broadly at the memory.
"I admire Blackstone's courage, if not his lack of good sense. Standing up against all the vested interests in this city takes real guts. We could do a lot more in our job if half our superiors weren't openly corrupt."
Hawk pulled at his collar again.
"What do you know about this sorcerer, Gaunt?"
"Not much. Fairly powerful, as sorcerers go, but he's not flashy about it. Likes to throw parties, but otherwise keeps himself to himself. Not married, doesn't chase women, or men, for that matter. No one knows where he came from originally, but rumor has it that he was once sorcerer to the king. Then he left the court under something of a cloud and came and settled here in Haven. Made a name for himself in the Hook. You remember that?"
"Yeah, I was part of the team that had to go in there and clean up the mess. We were still carrying out the bodies a week later."
"Oh, that's right. I was still working on the shattered bullion case."
Fisher looked at Hawk thoughtfully.
"You never told me about this before. Was it bad? I heard stories.
It was bad. There were no survivors among the gangs. No wounded, no dying, only the dead. We still don't know what killed them, but it wasn't very neat. Most of the bodies had been ripped apart. There's no doubt the gangs were evil. They did some terrible things. But what happened to them was worse.
And this is the man whose party we're attending as bodyguards? Great.
The large, heavy front door swung suddenly open. A bright, cheerful light filled the hall beyond and spilled out into the night. Hawk and Fisher blinked uncertainly as their eyes adjusted to the glare, and then they bowed politely to the man standing before them. Gaunt took in their guards' cloaks and inclined his head slightly in return.
Ah, William's bodyguards. Do come in. I've been expecting you.
Gaunt stepped back a pace and waited patiently as they made their way past him into the hall. He shut the door carefully and turned back to extend a slender, well-manicured hand.
Captain Hawk?
Hawk shook it firmly and then gritted his teeth as Gaunt all but crushed his fingers in a powerful grip. He hated people who did that. Somehow he kept his polite smile in place and then surreptitiously flexed his fingers as Gaunt turned to Fisher.
Captain Fisher.
The sorcerer took Fisher's hand and raised it to his lips. Hawk frowned slightly. He wasn't too keen on people who did that, either. Fisher smiled politely at the sorcerer. He wasn't quite what she'd expected. After Hawk's tale of what he'd found in the hook, she'd been expecting someone more impressive. With his mild gray eyes and pleasant smile, Gaunt just didn't look the part. The sorcerer looked at the two guards thoughtfully.
Captains Hawk and Fisher, I've heard of you.
Nothing good, I hope.
You did an excellent job taking care of the Chandler Lane vampire. Most impressive.
Hawk raised an eyebrow.
News travels fast in Haven.
I have my sources.
Yeah, I'll just bet you do.
If you'll follow me, Counselor Blackstone is already here, with some of my other guests.
Gaunt led the way down the hall to a heavy oaken door on the right. He pushed it open and then stood back to usher the two guards into the parlor. The guests looked briefly at Hawk and Fisher, took in the black cloaks, and went back to their conversations. Hawk looked casually about him, getting the feel of the place. Two huge windows were blocked off by closed wooden shutters, despite the heat. There was only the one door leading into the hall. Hawk relaxed a little. If push came to shove, it shouldn't be too difficult to defend the parlor against an attack, assuming anyone was suicidal enough to take on the sorcerer Gaunt in his own home. Gaunt went over to Blackstone and spoke quietly to him. Blackstone glanced at Hawk and Fisher, excused himself to the witch visage, and walked back with Gaunt to meet them. He shook them both by the hand, the usual quick, firm handshake of the seasoned politician.
Glad you're both here. I'm sure I'll feel a lot safer with you two at my side. Now, it's only for a few days until my bill has become law. After that, the danger will be over.
Really? The way I hear it, you've got more enemies in Haven than the Chancellor on tax day.
Well, the immediate danger anyway. If I'd wanted a safe occupation, I wouldn't have entered politics.
Well then, Counselor, what would you like us to do?
Well, for tonight, just mingle with the guests and enjoy yourselves. I'm in no danger here, not in Gaunt's house. Even my enemies know better than to risk his anger.
You're always safe here, William. This house is protected against any and all intrusions.
And now, if you will excuse us, Gaunt and I have some business to discuss. Do help yourself to a drink and something to eat.
The politician and the sorcerer moved away. Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
Free booze. This may not be such a bad assignment after all.
Yeah.
They made their way over to the punch bowl and helped themselves to the fruit cordial.
Yeah.
Hawk wrinkled his nose at the taste, but drank it anyway. The room was hot, he was thirsty, and besides, it was free. Various canapes had been laid out beside the punch bowl, arranged in interesting patterns in the mistaken belief that this would make the food appear more appetizing. Hawk didn't even recognize half of it, but he tried one anyway, just to show himself willing.
Not bad.
Glad you think so. Gaunt prides himself on his culinary skills.
Hawk chewed and swallowed quickly to empty his mouth as the counselor's wife looked him and Fisher over. She seemed friendly enough in a condescending way. Catherine's gaze lingered on Hawk more than Fisher, and he wondered if he'd imagined the sudden glitter in her eyes. The way she was acting, he half expected her to lean forward and pin a rosette on him.
So you're the best the guard could supply. I do hope you're as fearsome as your reputation suggests.
We try.
Catherine looked thoughtfully at his face.
The scars are certainly impressive, darling. What happened to your eye?
I lost it in a card game.
Catherine gave him a startled look.
Oh!
The giggles made her look much younger.
My dear, I think you won that one on points. Do help yourself to the spiced lamb. It's really quite delicious. I believe there's even some asparagus, though where Gaunt managed to get it at this time of year is beyond me. Knowing a sorcerer does have its advantages, I suppose.
There was a pause while they all busied themselves with the food. Fisher smiled suddenly as she prepared to bite into a piece of cold garlic sausage.
We could have used some of this earlier today.
What? Oh, the garlic. Gaunt was just telling us about the vampire before you arrived. Horrible creatures. Did you really kill it by driving a wooden stake through its heart?
Eventually.
Such a pity about Trask. I mean, he wasn't much of a counselor, but he did a good enough job. And at least you knew where you were with him. And his was a marginal seat, you know. Now there'll have to be another election, and I hate to think of who we might get in his place. Better the devil you know, and all that. Oh, Graham!
Hawk and Fisher nodded politely and said nothing. They hadn't told anyone about Trask being the vampire's Judas goat. They just passed him off as another victim, along with his daughter. It was true enough, in a way. And besides, his widow was going to have a hard enough time as it was. Catherine Blackstone fluttered away to talk to Graham Dorrimont. Hawk looked at Fisher.
Well, what did you make of that?
Beats me. Catherine Blackstone, coming on like an empty-headed socialite? That's not the woman I've heard so much about.
Maybe it's a test of some kind, checking us out to see if we're smart enough to see through the act.
Could be, I suppose.
Actually, it's a little more complicated than that.
Hawk and Fisher turned quickly to find the witch visage standing beside them. Hawk's hand dropped to his axe. He hadn't heard her approaching. Visage saw the movement and smiled slightly.
I'm not your enemy, Captain Hawk. In fact, I'm glad you're here. I've had a premonition about William.